Tonight on Arena, guitarist Sean Sheba talks up to us about the joys of playing electric and acoustic instruments. And Mirren Kelly, new artistic director of Taivyark na Gaillimhe. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival returns for its flagship festival from the 8th through until the 18th of May this year, with its most ambitious programme to date. Over the course of 2 weekends, the festival will deliver a selection of concerts at Rusborough House, St Mary's Church in Blessington and the Tramway Theatre, also in Blessington, County Wicklow. Highlights this May include a farmyard carnival, a new family-friendly festival commission and an Irish debut for the United Strings of Europe. But coming back to the festival this year after an online performance in 2021 is multi-Grammy nominee and Leonard Bernstein Award recipient guitarist Sean Sheba, who will be performing in St Mary's Church in Blessington on the Sunday, the 11th of May. Delighted to have Sean Sheba on the programme with me this evening. Sean, I'm looking at the picture of you in the brochure for the West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival, and it's you standing there almost cruciform in a kind of a cross type shape, and in one hand you're holding your electric guitar and in another hand you're holding your acoustic guitar. And you look very balanced, I have to say, holding the both of them. How essential are both instruments to how you approach playing guitar and to that achieving that balance?
I started playing the classical guitar when I was seven. Mm. And I suppose that, I mean, what's cool about guitars is that each iteration of the instrument and each country has its own kind of very vivid and lively cultural association with the instrument. It's quite a potent thing in that regard. So it's always been fun to tap into different ideas of what the instrument is. But it was actually quite late in life, relatively speaking, that I came to the electric guitar. So I only started taking it, onto the professional concert platform in around 2016, 2017. Obviously I dabbled with it a bit when I was a teenager, yeah. But it took me a while to kind of take it there.
Yeah, because I wondered about that. I think for many guitarists who were working within art music, if I can refer to it in that way, the starting point would probably be the classical guitar, and then they move towards the electric guitar later on. Is there any kind of I don't know, snobbery or idea that, well, the electric guitar is a lesser instrument, or has that changed in terms of art music in particular in more recent times?
I think what's cool about it is that certainly in the last 10 years, I've seen a huge uptick in the number of young composers who are treating the electric guitar really seriously in really serious, you know, Germanic contemporary music, you know? And I think that it's attractive in orchestral textures, for instance, because it's very loud. Mm. It can provide this kind of noise generation machine effect. Actually, a lot of the time being used in ways that sound totally antithetical to the classical guitar, to the guitar. So you can hear it in a way that actually doesn't sound plucked. It sounds like something else, some kind of hovering spaceship. So I think, you know, in terms of the kind of plethora of unexpected sounds that it can create, it's really attractive as a textural instrument. But I think also, you know, looking as far back as, like, you know, the 80s, we can think of, like, Romitelli's solo works for electric guitar. It has been an instrument which has been at various points at the forefront of really hardcore developments of contemporary music. I just think because classical music moves slowly, that it's taken a while for it to really kind of catch up. I don't think we're any faster now, but it's exciting to be part of that. I think there are a lot of composers who are interested in writing for the classical guitar who would never write for the electric guitar.
Yeah.
Vice versa is also true.
Yeah, so it is acceptable to love one or the other or both in your world. when you won the New Generation Artist, you were given that prestigious BBC New Generation Artist programme from 2012 through to 2014, which involved recording with a variety of BBC performers and orchestras. Had the electric guitar begun to make its way into your professional life at that point and finding repertoire for it? How difficult was it?
I think it was actually shortly after I left that I began really probing it.
Yeah.
The thing about the scheme is that it is so busy. You're really like doing, three recitals a year, broadcast live, recording 45 minutes of rep every 6 months, doing the usual concertos with the orchestras and collaborating with other people on the scheme as well. So you're kind of sifting through about 4 hours of rep every year. By the time it's done, you've kind of run out of tunes, as it were. So I think by receiving some breathing space by the end, which isn't at all to say that it's not a great opportunity. It's absolutely fantastic. It's just quite a roller coaster. By the time I'd have some breathing space, I think I was thinking about, I was able to think, I suppose, about like next steps.
Yeah.
And the route to the electric guitar that I took wasn't really, you know, riffing in my parents' basement. It was more that there was music that I really needed to play, and I knew that the classical guitar wasn't going to be able to adapt that music. So I'm thinking of things like music written originally for bagpipes, really powerful but multi-layered textures, which the classical guitar with its nylon strings with a slightly less plangent tone was just a less effective vehicle for. So it was really a repertoire-led discovery. Mm.
In fact, that might lead us nicely into one of the pieces that you're playing as part of the West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival, which is the Meredith Monk piece Nightfall. Am I right in thinking that this was originally written for choir?
That's right. So it was originally for choir. I think it was written for a group called Musica Sacra.
Mm.
Meredith, in this piece, she wanted to reference not only sacred music, it's obvious in the underlying bass ostinato that persists through most of the piece, as well as how the voices are divided. But I think also the changing light as sun sets. So a fitting time of day to be playing it on the radio and listening to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to come into a little bit into it, Sean, because it has that lovely thing which when you're listening to it.
Oh, I don't want to steal your script, sorry.
No, that's okay. Not at all, you're not stealing anything. It has that lovely quality that when you're listening to it, it starts so small and it builds and builds and builds. But given that we have limited time always in these matters, I have gone a little bit into the track, a couple of minutes into the tracks, if you'll forgive me that, when the guitar is not quite in full flight, but it's beginning to certainly make its way to the fore. Section there from Meredith Monk's Nightfall, one of the pieces that Sean Sheba will be playing at his concert in St Mary's Church of Ireland in Blessington in County Wicklow on Sunday the 11th of May as part of this year's West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival. And it always amazes me when I listen to people like you playing a guitar in that fashion, Sean. It does sound as if there are three or four people playing there. When you were shifting, you know, that shift from the classical nylon string, gut string guitar, when you're making that shift to the electrical to the electric instrument, were there a whole new set of techniques that you had to learn to get that multi-voiced element that we get in that piece?
Well, the multi-voice comes from the fact that I recorded each of the parts, right? There are 15 different voices singing. So
you couldn't manage 15 in the one go.
I'm sorry to disappoint, but yeah, not on that one. But there are different techniques. Of course, these are fundamentally different instruments in much the same way that composers are attracted to them or unattracted to them. I think they do that. That is because they do totally different things. And because they do totally different things, we have to approach them in totally different ways. The classical guitar is an instrument, I suppose, that is it's like half way to being a contrapuntal instrument, and being able to weave three or four different voices, like in the works of the keyboard works of Bach that we sometimes refer to as the lute suites. But the electric guitar is, yes, as I said before, it's sometimes more of a noise generation machine, but it's also, I guess, fundamentally more of a soloist's instrument too. It's quite melodic a lot of the time. And when it is not a soloist, when it is accompanying, it tends to do just...
Oh, I think we've lost Sean. Sean, we lost you briefly there. What does it tend to do when it's not a solo instrument?
Well, when it's accompanying, it tends to do that solely as well. So I think basically it tends to be an instrument. It can do many, many different things. But I think of it as something that is almost unlimited, because you can really just add on pedals, or you can turn the volume up to 11. And the guitar, the classical guitar, is perhaps the opposite in that is defined by its smallness. It is an instrument of the salons. It's a small C conservative instrument.
I'll come to a bit of Bach now in a minute, but it did strike me as you were saying that about what you can do with the electric guitar on your album Lost and Found, where that track, Nightfall from Meredith Monk, is on that album, your 2022 album, I believe it was. There are sections of that Hildegard von Bingen music where almost to my ears the guitar sounded like a pipe organ. It sounded like this huge big instrument. Now maybe you were doing two or three voices and recording them separately in that case too, but it has that facility when you can amp it up and add effects.
Well, Sean, I'm delighted to tell you that in that one I can play that solo.
That was all by itself.
On my own. There you are. Thank you for lining that one up for me. So I think that's one of the things as well. You know, it's not only pedals, it's also like little things that you can hold. Like in that case, it's an e-bow, which is magnets held together and then with an electrical pulse put through them so that it reverts the string indefinitely to create, yes, something like a pipe organ. Sometimes it sounds like bagpipes. Sometimes it sounds like a distorted electric violin, something like that.
Well, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I've talked too much. I'm rambling.
No, you're not. You're not rambling at all. Let me go to the Bach, and it's BWV 998. I believe we're going to listen to the prelude from that. And this is classic Bach on the classical guitar.
I think it might be the Allegro, actually.
Indeed, that is BWV 998. I think you said it probably is the Allegro. It sounds as if it has the speed of an Allegro in it, Sean Sheba.
It is. It's the final movement of the three part.
Yeah, the three parts of it. When it comes to Bach, are we talking in most cases about keyboard music being transcribed to the guitar, or are we talking about pieces that Bach may have written for lute that then you can work into the modern guitar?
So the four suites that we refer to as the lute suites, which then kind of sort of encompasses the Prelude, Fugue, and Allegro and the Prelude BWV 999, these are, you know, the subject of much debate in academic scholarship, and it does seem that some of them are very much possible on the lute, and some of them are almost impossible. I say almost because some very, very good lutenists have dealt with them, but they sometimes don't sound very good. And I think what's happened is that we now know that there was an instrument called the lute harpsichord, which pretty much looked like a harpsichord, we think. but had the resonance chamber and kind of the plucking technique of a lute. And this was a keyboard instrument. It puts 3.5, 3 to 4 voice fugues in context. These are works that are really tricky on guitar, require a lot of transposition. And yes, in some cases, I think they're almost definitely a keyboard works. What's cool about the lute harpsichord is that it is such an intimate instrument. It's an instrument that is intended not for virtuosic flights of performance, but for personal and spiritual edification and reflection.
Oh, very nicely put. And I suppose that is, there are links in some ways to the guitar when you think about it. Before the pianoforte, which had that facility to be loud and soft, the harpsichord had very little in terms of dynamic range. And that is, I presume, sometimes one of the great challenges with the classical guitar, particularly in the orchestral setting. It is that balance between potentially the big orchestra and the small guitar.
That's it. That's it. I mean, I think, you know, when I was younger, I was a lot more autocratic about it. And I thought, oh, God, we should never use amplification. But now these days, you know, amplification is getting better. And sometimes I'd rather play a quieter, more beautiful instrument, put it through a really great mic, than play some horrendous canon of a competition winning instrument that projects really well to the first few rows, but doesn't have much colour or anything else to distinguish it.
Which probably answers this question. Were you ever tempted, you were tempted forward from the classical guitar to the electric guitar in the latter part of your, where whatever, the middle part of your career, if we put it that way. Were you ever tempted back to the lute or one of those earlier stringed instruments?
Yeah, so actually on this, I mean, I'm leaving the day after tomorrow for the kind of tour of May, which will take me to Wicklow. But what I'm doing is leaving the lute in London, because I am playing the lute, the Renaissance lute, which is a very, very quiet instrument, but not in Ireland, sadly. I'm sort of spending a lot of time with it these days, a lot of time with the electric guitar and a lot of time with the classical guitar too.
Yeah. I want to play another track from, or a little bit of a track from Lost and Found, your 2022 album. This man, Moondog, as he is known as, and his role in contemporary American, well, of the last century, American culture, and his role in contemporary American music of that point in time when it was very exciting in New York, 60s, 70s, 80s. How do you define this great outsider who's at the centre of things?
It's kind of impossible, isn't it? I mean, even trying to describe the character to listeners, it just seems like an impossible task, even given the relatively generous airtime that I'm being given here. But Moondog was a blind homeless man on Fifth Avenue who dressed up as a Viking and was also a composer. And people like Philip Glass described him as being more influential and instructional in their compositional education than Juilliard. And I think what's extraordinary about his work is that, similar sometimes to works by, for instance, Monpoe, right, or Mozart, there is such an idea of innocence and kind of folklore. He's created melodies that are totally original, but at the same time feel like they've been there forever.
Yeah, the track that I've chosen from Lost and Found is Pastoral, which is incredibly simple. But this is one of the great joys, I suppose, of things that are, in inverted commas, simple, that when you sit back and listen to them properly, there's huge complexity and difficulty in that simplicity getting there.
Definitely. Absolutely. Love this track. Pastoral's great. Thank you.
opening section there of Pastoral, Moondog composition arranged for electric guitar by Sean Sheba, who's with me on the programme this evening. And there is a little section there, Sean, where just when that higher little section comes in above the repeated bass line, where it does sound, to my ears again, a touch of the pipe organ in there.
Oh, really? Well, I'm adding. It's funny. Somebody sent me an article which was a review of that album a few days ago, and it said Sheba's tasteful arrangements. And I thought, oh God, sometimes I'm actually cranking up the reverb pretty high. I'm not sure how tasteful it is, but you know, I think we were trying to, over the course of myself and the producer, we're trying to create this ambience of nostalgia. You know, things that have been lost, in the sense that, as I said before, they feel like they've been there for such a long time. They've been there forever. Kind of a selection of different objects, almost a potpourri of things you had in your childhood. You know, in a trinket box.
So it's a memory piece that, yeah, I don't know if you saw that it was the Guardian review that talked about it's perilously close to ambient music. What was their problem, do you think, with ambient music? And do you try to avoid ambient music in terms of what you were making on that album in particular?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there's a lot of like stuff that's being produced for playlists or like, you know, it's a matter of taste, really. But like, you know, I thought it was very sweet that you tried to frame me earlier as being not a snob because I play the electric guitar. But sometimes I think I'm a bit of a snob, you know, I don't want to be. But sometimes I'm like, oh, poo poo, Ian Audi, don't like that stuff, you know. And I think there's a lot of ambient music, which I do think is a bit trashy. We all have our different red lines, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not always exactly sure where mine is, but I do think that I was, on this album, this is probably the closest that I come to, you know, kind of ambient Muzak style stuff.
Well, I suppose it's only ambient if it's on in the background and you're doing something else. If you sit down and listen
exactly,
to it, it ceases being ambient.
Constant vigilance.
Sean, lovely to speak with you, and thanks for being with us this evening on Arena.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Sean Sheba, who will be playing at 3:30 on Sunday afternoon, the 11th of May in St Mary's Church of Ireland in Blessington as part of the West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival. And you can find out full details on the website about that and all of the events happening over those two weekends. WestWicklowFestival.com. Ireland's National Irish Language Theatre, Cathaoirleach na Gaillimhe, this week launches a nationwide tour of a new production of Pauline Goldsmith's beloved Irish wake play, Dathana Gealla Amháin, or you may know that as Bright Colours Only. It's a one-woman show which explores Irish rituals and traditions around death. It's been performed on stages all over the world, but this is its first translation into Irish. The new production stars Breedin Níomhaíl Downey, and it opens this Thursday at An Taibhearc in Galway before embarking on a tour that will bring it all over the country. Delighted to be joined from our Galway studio this evening by Muireann Kelly, new artistic director of An Taibhearc, who is also the director of this show, and the aforementioned Breedin Níomhaíl Downey, the star of the one-woman show, who has all of this work to do in terms of the many characters and voices that she will have to give us on the evening. But our Deuce Fáilte Roimh an Mhaireachtaí, Muireann, this is a classic play from Pauline Goldsmith, first produced in the early 2000s. You have a bit of a history with it yourself, but we'll get to that. Tell us what the play is about.
Gurmagath, thanks for inviting us on this evening. It's a Belfast story. Pauline is from Belfast herself, although she's lived many years in Scotland, where I met Pauline, and where I had the good fortune to see her original production before, as you said, she started world domination and toured around the country and then literally around the world, sometimes touring in a hearse. So places like Brazil, Norway, London. But this is the first opportunity we have really, our audiences have, to come and experience it as Gaeilge. For those who are on the road with their Gaeilge, there's Fó Hiodálainn, so the surtitles. And I suppose just going back to Pauline, It's a very accessible piece. It's a piece about really Pauline's memories and stories that she would have experienced, characters she would have known growing up from her family and the community. And in that way, I feel like that's what's timeless about the piece. I think people will feel very comfortable and familiar and invited literally into a wake house where you'll have a wee dram and a cup of tea and a sandwich, as with all good wakes.
And by the way, does that happen? Because certainly the sections of the script that I looked at, there was a suggestion that there might be a cup of tea and a sandwich, egg and onion, I'm presuming.
100%.
Yeah, so, by Capri-Yan, there will be Capri.
August cup on taste, Capri Keisha. You couldn't have a decent wake unless you had a good. They'd be talking about you if you don't make a decent sandwich.
I've been testing them out all week, and there's a great variation so far. I think the tuna's my personal favourite, but you know, each.
Oh, there you go. So Shin Breach is beating the wheel downy, breeding the wheel downy. Who not only do you make the sandwiches as well as playing? Is it upwards of 15 characters, Breedine?
I mean, I'm a little bit too busy now to be making the sandwiches, but I'm very happy to test them. Like I said, you need the energy, you know, between all these characters.
Yeah, give us a sense. I mean, you can't describe all of the characters, but there is a kind of a banity feel to the woman who greets, or the hostess who greets us at the beginning of the play, and in some ways leads us through the various characters that you play, Breedine.
Absolutely. And she really anchors the entire show. She's very warm, very welcoming, and really puts the audience at ease as they come in. Because throughout the play, there is also a lot of audience interaction, and you need kind of somebody, I suppose, warm and welcoming for them to take part and to play along with that as well. And it also provides great contrast for some of the other characters who come later on in the show. And it's great to be able to go back to her in between the characters as well.
Give us a sense of some of those that you have to give us. I know that there's a funeral, an undertaker at one point who is there kind of bringing us through the do's and the don'ts of embalming,
yes,
etc.
A very serious and sassy funeral director, as all funeral directors should be, really. We also have a very lovable great aunt who likes to talk about the dreams she had and her aspirations. And we might have a cranky wee granny as well that we're all probably a little familiar with in our own families. So there's really something there for everyone, and I think people that we can all recognise in our own lives as well.
I was saying, Muireann, that you had a history with the play. You know, you mentioned that you saw Pauline Goldsmith's own first production of the play, the one that went on to tour extensively. But you subsequently, you actually performed in the play Os Gaeilge agus Scots Gaelic, anna?
Yep.
The two languages.
Yeah, so Camero Tomeod Nisnifa Gaelic no Toming Wilga. So I am having lived in Scotland for over 30 years, and for the last 10 years I ran a Gaelic theatre company, Theatre Galore, in Glasgow. So I actually probably I'm more comfortable in Gaelic than, which helps with the Gwydor dialect. So there's a bit of a fusion here going on. But so we, a good while ago, somebody thought it would be a good idea to play some of the characters in Gaelic and some in Gaeilge. Mm. I'm not so sure, but we gave it a go. But it did, I suppose, plant a seed in my head about the connections between how well we do wakes in Ireland, and having lived in Scotland for 30 years, not to say anything about what they do in Scotland, I just felt there was a real opportunity here for a really decent translation, and rooting it in Breedine's dialect from Gwydor makes perfect sense, because often families in Belfast will have, their Irish will have come from Donegal,
yeah,
and will have its roots in there. And then the play itself makes an awful lot of sense in terms of the wake house. So I felt, I suppose somewhere along the line, those little seeds stayed with me, and it's lovely to get a chance to do it. And as I said, it's completely accessible for anyone who is learning Irish, has cúpla focal, or just Gaeilge curious.
Yeah.
We would love for people to feel really welcomed irrespective. Yeah. And then obviously if you're Leafa, then just go awry, as Breedin would say.
Yeah, I guess Captain that Nian Shishin Latsa go more Breedin the Quilig of Fain, good a good the door of a Halara Chagat there in Thatcha.
Go kentse, agus is thoi hig arad special te éifaste drama a ganu in cholu agus a ganu in ghidoor a vé in sa taivierc jering bachar gresion hiad wair gurú show sa canu in sin o hús jeru agus rodi in ta special te ton a fwaes an ees rin misse mo chud ashtid arte leig an awr clan ghidoor agus beimid a galar ash ga awr clan ghidoor faste
Bech a sin gajas to be bringing it all kinche. Yeah, bringing it all back home. You mentioned that maybe, I presume, Mirren, you were suggesting that the Scots could learn a little bit about from us regarding Wicks. But you have been involved in Scots Gaelic theatre for quite a period of time, as you've said. What lessons did you learn within the artistic directorship of Galore that you might think now might be useful to start to employ within Taivearc na Gaillimhe?
Yeah, it's interesting because on Taivearc is Aireachlann Náisiúnta today, so it's a national company, and I feel like it should reflect and represent people and their stories right across this island. And I think even in English language theatre, often in Ireland, the stories from the north of Ireland and places like Donegal, Belfast, aren't always represented. And I feel also where we are in relation to the stories we now have and remember about the times in the 80s and 90s, it's a really good time to reflect and to think about those things. So although it's not a play about the Troubles at all, it's not a political play in any way, it's set in that time, and you can't dislocate it from that time.
Yeah, in fact, there's a particular mention of the events like the Militown Cemetery attack
and absolutely.
The subsequent killings of two British Army corporals. Those are mentioned, but they're not the centre of what the play is about.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So what Pauline does brilliantly is, which again is back to representation, how you can tell a story that is extremely personal and might be of a specific time, but because it's actually so rooted in truth and in its foundations of truth and that kind of personal stuff, it actually then comes to life on stage in a really universal way and a kind of timeless way. And I think for me, the fact that on Taivearc is a national theatre, we should be representing those stories. We should be talking, using, Canúint as Gwydor, as Ciri, as, Balioclia. It should be, all these stories and folk that use and listen and love the language should be represented on that stage.
And so important too for those different Canúints to be heard.
Absolutely.
To be heard on stages.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons we wanted to start the whole programme for this year, this new programme at Taivearc, which we're very grateful to the department on RIN for supporting us. It's the first time we've really, I suppose, been supported at the level at which we're starting to work on the programme. It gives us a chance to really be strategic and to things like touring is not cheap, and it's challenging, and it was important to me that in our first year we didn't just make, I suppose, more typical work that people would assume we'd make. I feel like we need to tell contemporary stories. We also need to look back at the classic canon. We need to reach younger audiences. This piece, I feel, is a very accessible piece, and we should say it's funny.
It is very funny in places. It is very funny, and yes, because there's a dark humour within part
absolutely.
Of it as well. And
also pure Belfast, Belfast black humour,
very much, which will sound right. A Canúint Gwydor, that's for sure. And we should say that is it the next production or an upcoming production that will be Gaelic in the Moon that will be represented there, Munster Irish.
Yeah, well, you may hear flavours of other Canúint are available, as we say. Yeah, no, I mean, I've been really strategic in the programming, and I feel like representation in this day and age. Of all kinds of people who embrace our culture and our language should be seen on the stage. So, yeah, we're trying to make sure we cover a little bit of something for everyone throughout the whole programme.
Well, Gormagav Bercha, Svetling, and Nochter and Glor.
Grimmilamagat.
Nashin, Brigine Niwil Downey, the actor, and Muireann Kelly, new artistic director of An Taibhearc, telling us about the upcoming production of Dahana Gala Awain. The show opens at An Taibhearc in Galway City this Thursday, May the 1st, runs through until May the 10th, and then it will tour around the country for the month of May to Arclan Guidoor in Dunamal, the Linenhall Centre in Castlebar, Axis in Ballymun in Dublin, and finally Culturalin Macadam Ofeach in May. In Belfast. Full detail of the tickets, etc., on the website on taibhearc.com. Well, some interesting news that has just come our way. The Abbey Theatre and the National Theatre of Great Britain are announcing a co-production of Tom Murphy's A Whistle in the Dark, directed by Abbey Artistic Director Katrina McLaughlin and starring Paul Mescal. McLaughlin will also direct James Hinks, the Playboy of the Western World, at the National Theatre in London later this year. But that's quite the announcement, and I'm sure we will hear more about it. Tom Murphy's A Whistle in the Dark, co-production between the Abbey and the National Theatre of Great Britain, and starring Paul Mescal. Earlier this month, English actress Judy Christie turned 85, one of the most celebrated actors of her generation. Christie is the star of Dr. Zhivago, Far From the Madding Crowd, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Don't Look Now, Shampoo, Heaven Can Wait, and Away From Her. She starred with lots of other things as well. She's an Oscar winner, Golden Globe winner, two-time BAFTA winner, as well as a recipient of over 40 critics' prizes. She was born in India in 1940, but she never really embraced the Hollywood life of celebrity and fame, turning down a series of high-profile roles, preferring to live quietly on her farm in North Wales. Here to take us through her varied career is Stephen Benedict. Before we talk to Stephen, let's hear her breakthrough role. This is from her 1963 film, Billy Liar, where she played the free-spirited Liz, who was the muse to Tom Courtney's Billy Fisher, the Billy Liar of the title of the film. He's a frustrated screenwriter, dreams but secretly fears of getting away to London. Liz, however, played by Judy Christie, has the gumption to do just that.
But Billy, why don't you go to London? I'll come with you.
Oh, it'd be marvellous if we could.
But we can, Billy, we can. What's there to stop us?
Well, I mean, there are all sorts of arrangements to make.
No, there's not. You just buy a ticket. You buy a ticket and get on a train. That's all you have to do.
You can't just go.
Yes, you can. We could go tonight. No. There's a midnight train. It gets into London at 7 o'clock.
But tonight, Liz?
Yes, 12:05 from Central Station. We'll be in London tomorrow. Breakfast at Lyons. Hyde Park in the afternoon. Piccadilly tomorrow evening. Look, what time is it?
It's just after 10.
I'm going, Billy. You're coming with me.
Yes, Liz. I'm coming.
Sure?
I'm coming with you.
Right. I'll meet you at the barrier about 12 o'clock, all right?
Fine, yeah.
Hey, what are you going to tell your father and mother?
Oh, they know about it already, more or less.
Billy, you won't let me down, will you?
No, of course I won't. Come on.
Right, I'll go back and get me things.
We're going to London!
There you go. We had Judy Christie there as Liz and Tom Courtney as Billy Fisher in the film Billy Liar, the breakthrough role for Judy Christie. And with me in the studio is Stephen Benedict. I was just asking as we were listening to that clip, Stephen, how established was she? Because that was the big breakthrough woman for her in 1963. What had she done previous to that?
Her first speaking part came 2 years earlier on a BBC futuristic sci-fi drama called A for Andromeda, and she played the title role. I watched a little bit of it on YouTube. It's very, very much of its time. But clearly, Julie Christie knew how she had this gift of knowing how to use the camera. The phrase in the industry is she eats the camera, and she did, even on this very paltry BBC show. But she got the gig from Billy Liar off that. And the amazing thing about the movie Billy Liar, her performance as Liz, the girl who goes to London and Billy doesn't, that actually predicted what happened to Julie Christie's life within 2 years, because within 2 years she was cast as in the movie Darling, where she played this fashion model, Diana Scott, who goes through swinging London, has a number of goes through a number of relationships and ends up marrying an Italian aristocrat. And in the very same year, she won the Oscar for that performance in the movie Darling at the age of 24. Mm. And in the very same year, she was appearing in Dr. Zhivago. So she literally went from nowhere to stratospheric. But the amazing thing is, you mentioned there that she'd turned down a number of roles,
yeah,
and she had to be strong-armed to play the character of Lara in Zhivago.
Every actress worth her salt wanted to be that, wanted that part.
That's right. I mean, Jane Fonda lobbied hard for it, Sarah Miles. There was, I mean, even the movie's producer, Carlo Ponti, had purchased the movie's, the rights to Dr. Zhivago specifically for his wife, Sophia Loren, to play the role of Lara. And David Lean, who had just come off Lawrence of Arabia, having won the Oscar for that, and Bridge on the Requi, stood up to Carlo Ponti and said, she will not play the role. She's not right for the role. And Ponti says, well, who is? And by that stage, David Lean had seen a little of Billy Lyre, a little bit of Julie Christie and Billy Lyre, but she was making a movie in Dublin at the time with John Ford. She was appearing in Young Cassidy about the young Sean O'Casey. And David Lean phoned up John Ford and said, well, what's she like? And he says, she's the best young thing I've seen ever. She knows exactly how to move the, use the camera. So that was the way she was cast, but she still turned it down three times.
And do we know how he finally persuaded her?
No, we don't. I mean, that's the thing about Julie Christie's career, is she's incredibly enigmatic and very, very private, almost like Greta Garbo. I mean, not that private and not that secretive. But the thing is, I think throughout her career, Julie Christie has suffered from imposter syndrome, which is true of a lot of actors, but I think she's had it in the extreme. She's often wondered, how on earth did I get here, especially in the early part of her career.
Let's have a listen to her in Dr. Zhivago as Lara. And Zhivago himself and Lara are alone one evening in the hospital serving during the Civil War. Omar Sharif, of course.
Omar.
The dark brown eyes coming out of the camera, and Julie Christie with the bright blue eyes,
that's
coming
right
out of the camera as the tragic lovers here in the David Lean epic.
In a couple of weeks, you'll be with your little girl.
I want to be with Katia more than anything in the world.
Yes, of course.
Now that we're going, I feel sad. Sad. Really sad.
Well, we've been here some time.
Yes. This must have been a lovely house once. Don't you think?
What are you going to do?
In Grado?
Yes.
I'll be all right.
I wish I could think so. I could run a laundry.
What will you do?
I suppose I'll go back to the hospital.
It's funny to think of you there. I used to pass it on my way to school.
Do you ever come to Moscow?
From Grado.
If only there were someone to look after you. But of course, if there were, I'd be destroyed by jealousy.
Zhivago, don't. My dear, don't, please. Yuri, we've been together 6 months. On the road and here. And we've not done anything you'll have to lie about to Tonya. I don't want you to have to lie about me. Do you understand that, Yuri?
Oh, that is Julie Christie as Lara and Omar Sharif as Zhivago in that clip from Dr. Zhivago. We're celebrating the 85th, a couple of weeks back, of 85th birthday of Julie Christie, with Stephen Benedict with me here in studio. And just it's the sheer passion of that. And so many, in the olden days, so many Christmases were spent watching. I mean, what is it? A 3 hour movie?
Three and a half, And Easter Mondays would be another one. Easter Bank Holiday Mondays.
Well, you've needed to watch it over the two periods. You'd be asleep for half of it during each one. Anyway, let's move on to her perhaps her most famous film, Don't Look Now, which was an adaptation of Daphne du Maurier, a story set in Venice.
That's right, yeah. Now, the interesting thing about that movie, it's a great examination of grief, and I think it displays fully the great range that Julie Christie has as an actress, because within 2 years, she was playing a comedy with Warren Beatty and Goldie Hawn and Shampoo. The same year that she did Don't Look Now, she was on stage on Broadway doing Uncle Vanya. And then a couple of years previously, she was playing a 19th century farmer in England, Bathsheba Everdeen, in Far From the Madding Crowd. In 1971, she was playing a bordello, a madam, in the Frontier Western with Warren Beatty, McCabe and Mrs. Miller. And the thing about Don't Look Now, which is quite interesting, some of your listeners may not know this, the director of Don't Look Now, Nicholas Roeg, had worked with her on 3.5 films prior to that as cinematographer. He began his career as a cinematographer before becoming director. And they'd worked together in 1968 in Petulia, 1967 Far From the Madding Crowd, and 1966 in Fahrenheit 451, and also on half of Dr. Zhivago. He was the cinematographer in Dr. Zhivago and was fired. So when they came to work together on Don't Look Now, they had a great rapport. They had a great trust in one another. Nick is going to do his thing and Julie's going to do her thing and we're both fine.
You've mentioned Warren Beatty a few times here.
Yeah.
define the nature of their relationship. Okay, of course, well, he's so vain, he thinks this item is about him.
Yeah.
practicing that all day.
They started dating in 1967 on and off for about 7 years. And he had just become a Hollywood juggernaut in 1967, having starred and produced the movie Bonnie and Clyde. And his deal with the studio was so great that he earned $30 million off that picture in 1967. Mm. If you adjust that to inflation today, that's close to $250 million. And that's how big a star Warren Beatty was. But just before the movie came out, there was a big profile of him in the movie Esquire magazine, written by a guy called Rex Reed. And the title of the article was, "Will the Real Warren Beatty Please Shut Up?" And it eviscerated Beatty and it presented him as nothing more than a feather-brained pretty boy. And he vowed then from there on never to be taken advantage of by a journalist again. And Julie Christie studied that very, very closely. And she said, I'm not going to do the same thing. I'm not going to do press. I'm not going to do interviews. I'm not going to do a TV show. And in actual fact, Sean, it wasn't until 1988, a quarter of a century after she burst onto the scene in 1963 with Billy Liar, 1988, she does her first TV interview. And even then, the only reason why she did it was because she was promoting a documentary which she had narrated about the Khmer Rouge and the genocide committed in Cambodia. And that's the only reason she went on TV. So she uses her fame to promote other stuff, not herself. It's quite remarkable. And can you imagine an actress not doing television for 25 years?
I mentioned that she was born in India. Did she go back to her place of birth?
She did.
I mean,
yeah.
Very much obviously part of that whole Raj era, and it would have been a very British family, so shipped off to school, I presume, as quickly as early as possible.
That's right. Well, you know, her parents, her father ran a tea plantation in Chambua in northern India, and unbeknownst to her mother, he had had a relationship with an Indian lady working on the plantation before they got married. And there was a young child as a result of that relationship. Her mother never knew about this. And then she discovered, and then Julie was carted back to England in 1946. You can just imagine the culture shock of going from India to post-war Britain. And then she goes back to India in 1983 to make a movie called Heat and Dust, made by Merchant Ivory. I'm being polite, it's not a good film.
However, she did come back in a little bit later.
She did.
Was she in her 60s when she made Away From Her?
That's right. And that was her fourth Oscar nomination. 10 years early in 1997, she won an Oscar nomination for Afterglow. But in 2007, she delivers for me what is her greatest performance. And it's a beautiful thing to figure out, to think that she goes out at the top of her career. She gets another Oscar nomination for a portrayal of a lady called Fiona who is suffering from Alzheimer's disease.
And Gordon Pinsent plays her husband, Grant, and here's a scene between the two of them.
What?
You could just open the drawers. Remind yourself.
What?
Maybe all the labels and lists are defeating the purpose. If you stop thinking about things the moment you write them down, maybe that's the end of your need to recall.
I heard a story at a dinner party about the German soldiers on border patrol in Czechoslovakia during the war. I heard it from that Czech student of yours, Veronica. We spoke once at a dinner party. Don't be nervous. It's a good story. She told me that each of the German patrol dogs wore a sign saying Hund. Why, said the Czechs, and the Germans replied, because that is a Hund.
Julie Christie there had to deliver that line from Away From Her, Oscar nominated, and celebrated her 85th birthday in recent times. Stephen Benedict with us in studio celebrating that for us on this Tuesday evening. And that's our lot for tonight's arena. Paula Shields researched, Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, Paul Murnock was on sound, and tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1, when, amongst other things, we will be talking to, I can't just find it in me in front of be that. Anyway, we will have a lovely program for you to. For you tomorrow night when I finally get to work out what's on it, which will be tomorrow morning. In the meantime, should I hand over quickly? I think I should, to Ray Cudahy, who's in for John Creedon.